It's Lions, Towers, and Shields, Episode 2, and I'm Shelley, your host. This is the show where we talk about old movies, classic movies, whatever way you want to phrase it, movies that were made before you were probably born. And I have two great panelists joining me today, Dr. Drang making his return appearance. Hello.
Hello. Good to be back.
Good to have you back. And Moises Chuyan, welcome to the show.
I say I am so excited I'm going to do a front handspring.
Oh my goodness, I didn't know there was going to be Cary Grant impersonation. A front handspring, not a back handspring.
I dare say.
To make a differentiation. Excellent. Yeah, so we will be getting to the main event of the evening, which is a recap, review, reconsideration of Holiday. But before we do that, I thought we would dive into the old movie news such as it is. I'm going to be honest with you, friends. As I'm getting the show together, I am finding that sometimes there's a lot of movie news and sometimes there's a little movie news. So the quality and amount will vary. I want to start with a book I came across, which is a fiction book, but it is based entirely on a photograph of Anna May Wong, Marlene Dietrich, and Leni Riefenstahl, which is just an interesting combination. It was taken in Berlin in 1928, and this author decided to write a book about it. And I'm finding it interesting. I'm partway through. I've got a link to a very short review of the book, but if you're at all interested in sort of cross-commingling intersections of interesting lives, I think it's worth taking a look at. It's called Delayed Rays of a Star, and it's by Amanda Lee Coe, and it's on Penguin, and there will be a link in the show notes.
I had never seen that photo before.
Neither had I, actually.
It's one heck of a weird fit of a girl gang.
It is. I can see Marlene Dietrich and Leni Riefenstahl together.
Yeah.
But
yeah. But I mean, you add Leni Riefenstahl to almost any
That always makes it weird.
And yeah,
that's going to make it weird.
Yeah, this is a weird reboot for Birds of Prey.
and it's 1928, which is like, everything these people were going to do had not happened to them yet. Mm-hmm. So it's just super interesting. And they're all in Berlin. Dietrich and Riefenstahl were in Berlin because that's where they lived. Anna May Wong was already in Hollywood making movies and came to Berlin to promote one of her very earliest films. And so they run into each other at a party. And I don't know much about the real story of the photo. I think it's probably just one of those, hey, we're at a party. Let's take a picture of sort of famous people. And then the author turned it into a novel, which is
a weird but related tangent to the movie that's the central topic of the episode. In the 1930 version of Holiday, in the 38 version, there's a professor and teacher husband wife pairing the male half of that equation is Edward Everett Horton in both movies. And then right. The 1930 movie, the wife is played by Hedda Gabler, who in 1930 was not the Hedda Gabler that she would become. Hedda Hopper. very different Hedda.
I like it. I'm imagining that.
just seeing people who are so incredibly well known for something before they become that well known thing is fascinating, because I feel like people get frozen in amber in terms of the way that they're thought of. And, you know, they're thought of as the huge inimitable star or the huge icon, and not the person that became that icon, that became that brand name that you slap a label on it and it's on a shelf.
Hedda Hopper was actually in a lot of really early 30s movies. And if you
she was
didn't know her. Yeah, she was.
She just
popped up in like third or fourth leads and never really got anywhere, and her son was an actor too, William Hopper. But yeah, I think she probably made a good career move for herself.
Those who can't, Gossip Report.
Yeah. So I wanted also to mention briefly what's going on, TCM goings on. I'm going to try and get a little bit more out front information, because the website itself doesn't tell you up until the beginning of the next month what's about to happen, but I did a little digging, and there are a couple of themes. There's going to be a journalists on film theme later in the month at TCM, and also something called Life at Sea, which I guess would be seagoing movies of some kind. And they'll have their usual Star of the Month and some various other spotlights that I haven't been able to find. But as I say, I'm getting myself practiced at finding all these things ahead of time, because they are all planned. I'm not under any illusions that they have no idea what's going to happen in about a week on TCM.
Well, the journalism one looks really good. You know, starting off with one of my favorite movies is All the President's Men. I love it. I've watched it so many times, and I just it never gets tiresome for me.
Also on TCM, we talked about Kirk Douglas last time around, who passed away, and TCM has gotten the standard star tribute up for him. That will be on March 5th, so that will take over their programming for that day. I think it would be a fun job to be the person at TCM who programs the "This Person Has Died" day on TCM. I would enjoy that job. Of course, I'd enjoy most jobs at TCM, I suppose. And somewhat related, and Dr. Drang brought this to our attention, and it's a good reminder, there's a service out there called Canopy, which a lot of people have access to who probably do not know they have access to. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Canopy and why this kind of came up?
Yeah, Canopy, which is spelled with a K, is a streaming service that I guess you can pay for, but I imagine that most people don't. I imagine most people get it through their library. That's certainly how I got it. I have an individual login, but it's all based on my my library card, and it's kind of it's very spotty, like a lot of streaming services are. But you can find decent things, and my library gives me, I think it's 8 or 12 viewings a month, and which is more than I've ever used by far. There's a lot of arty kind of stuff, and there's
foreign films, art films,
documentaries are a big part of it as well. But there's good old stuff in there, and I've and it's kind of rotating. So if you miss it, you missed it. I believe you've missed Dial M for Murder, if you are interested in seeing that, because I saw that a few weeks ago, and it seems to be gone now. But they have, which is why Shelley brought this up, they recently brought Ace in the Hole, a Kirk Douglas movie that's also a journalism movie. It's been on there, I think, you know, since shortly after his death. And it's still a movie. I have still not seen it, but it's there on my list to dig into. You know, if you have been, as I have been, cut off from TCM because your cable company wants to bundle it with so many things that you do not want that would ultimately double your cable bill, Canopy is a good way to get, you know, certainly not the depth that TCM has, and certainly not the kind of background that you can get from watching TCM, but the movies are there, at least some of them are, and if you keep a good eye on it, you'll find some good stuff.
On that same note, I'm a big advocate for finding out what your public library service has here in Austin. Your Austin public library card gets you access to Canopy, Hoopla, and Libby, and mm-hmm. you should sign up for all three of them. Even if you only use Hoopla to watch the Gwyneth Paltrow version of Emma, or Florence Foster Jenkins, or A Man Called Uwe, or you know, some random thing that you would never want to pay for.
I think I did watch Florence Foster Jenkins on that, as it happens. And if you're affiliated with a university, maybe it's through the university library specifically or just the university in general, you can also get access to Canopy. That's how I got my connection. And Canopy has apps, I know there's a Roku app. There's probably an Apple TV app. But if you have a box, a streaming device of some sort, and you can get attached to Canopy, you should be able to browse through things and stream them just as you would on any other service.
Oh, yep. Look at this. The Man Who Killed Hitler and then the Bigfoot on Hoopla. Wow.
All right.
Finally true cinema.
I know. That's a double feature. So last thing I wanted to mention was the Noir City Festivals. If you're not familiar with the Film Noir Foundation festivals that go to various film towns across the country, the big one is in San Francisco every January. I've had the pleasure of going once or twice and really enjoyed it. There's also one coming to my hometown in Austin in May, but I'm mentioning it now because the Hollywood iteration, which is about a week long, and it has the greatest likelihood of getting famous people and being in interesting theaters. It's in the Egyptian theater usually, so it's quite a good show to go to. And what they tend to do with the Noor City is they kind of debut the themes and the restorations and the films they're going to show this year they haven't shown before in San Francisco in January, so you can kind of get a sense of what's going to be at the later film festivals, even if you haven't seen the schedule for it. But the Hollywood one is coming up in March, so if you are in LA, give it a thought. Well, shall we talk about Holiday?
Yes, let's.
If you insist.
Oh, all right. I know, you weren't prepared at all. So Holiday is a movie from 1938, released by Columbia, directed by George Cukor. As Moises mentioned, it was made first in 1930, a much less distinguished film, I'd say, but it actually did pretty well at the box office, which surprised me somewhat. It's based on a Philip Barry play, he who also wrote The Philadelphia Story and The Animal Kingdom. Both of those plays, Holiday and Philadelphia Story, were kicking around. I should say Holiday and Animal Kingdom were kicking around in the 1920s. Philadelphia Story is somewhat later. But Philip Barry likes to write about rich people in various ways. Of course, there are many authors that fit that profile, I suppose.
What a choice just as the Depression kicks in.
Right. Yeah, and actually there's a couple of interesting bits about the way the 1938 version of Holiday differed from the 1930 version that have a little bit to do with where the Depression was. The 30 version is very similar to the play, which apparently made, if not its Broadway debut, it had an opening night on the night of the stock market crash.
Bingo.
And the Broadway version starred Hope Williams, who the wonderful booklet essay in the Criterion edition by Dana Stevens talks about how Katharine Hepburn understudied the part she ended up playing in the 38 movie in the play and idolized the woman who played it on Broadway and only subbed in for her once.
Right.
And I'll get into some other weird stuff about that. But I found it fascinating that Katharine Hepburn was involved in it at that point and finally got the part.
And she was, Hope Williams, I don't know very much about other than in the context of Holiday, but Hope Williams is compared to Katharine Hepburn or vice versa. I don't think Williams made any films or many films. I certainly don't know what her shtick was or what she was like, but they were certainly compared. So I think the play is 1928, something like that. And then the 1930 movie starred Anne Harding. As you mentioned earlier, Edward Everett Horton played essentially the same part in the 1930 and 38 versions. The difference is that in the 1930 version, he was a friend of the Katharine Hepburn character, Linda, and was much more sort of an upper-class rebel like she was, whereas the 1938 version, one of the concessions they made to the Depression was they wanted the Potters, he and Jean Dixon, who play his wife, to be a much more middle-class couple.
Yeah, they were the now extant middle class, working class types who were friends with Johnny Case. And I love that the Criterion edition not only makes the 38 movie look gorgeous and has some good standard extras, but they include the entire 1930 movie. So
yes,
if you want to watch it, great. If you want to watch 30 minutes of it, just to kind of see the way that they diverge and how very 1930 it feels, great. You knock yourself out.
Did I even mention that Cary Grant is in the 1938 version? So it's George Cukor, Katharine Hepburn, Cary Grant. If that set of people sounds familiar, it's because not only will they go on to do Philadelphia Story, the Philip Barry play 2 years later, but this is the third movie that Hepburn and Grant have made together. And Cukor had been working with Hepburn since her very first film in 1932, and they ended up working together something like 10 times over the course of her career. So this was not a group of people that was new to one another. Hepburn had been at RKO for all the rest of her films since 1932, and then she pretty much got labeled box office poison along with Marlena Dietrich and Joan Crawford and a bunch of other people for whom that seems sort of laughable. But the box office poison label comes from film distributors who were having trouble selling Hepburn pictures and other pictures made by these women. And as a result, she was getting crummy parts at RKO and wanted out of her contract. And there's some other bits to that having to do with Philadelphia Story and Howard Hughes. But essentially, George Cukor said, hey, I'm waiting to be able to start making Gone with the Wind. Why don't you come over with me and go come to Columbia and we can make this little movie? And So that was Cukor's pre-Gone with the Wind project. I think Holiday went a little better for him.
She had the means to and bought her way out of her RKO contract so that she could make this movie. And the other historical thing that I find fascinating, as you touched on this being the third movie that she made with Cary Grant, Holiday came out in June of 38. Bringing Up Baby came out and bombed in February of 38. And only Bringing Up Baby only became like an A picture as the people involved in it became more famous and it was being shown on the repertory circuit, which I had no idea. I thought Bringing Up Baby was a hit right out of the gate. And I didn't realize that these two excellent Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn pictures dropped within 4 months of each other.
Yeah, both versions of Holiday did well at the box office, but Bringing Up Baby, you're right, it didn't do well at all and was probably one of the precipitators for Hepburn's career at RKO kind of ending, which ended up being good for her in the long run. And as you say, she had the means with Howard Hughes' help to buy out her contract and ended up going fairly quickly into the play Philadelphia Story, which was her big success, which allowed her to come back to MGM and say, hello, I would like you to make this movie. You can only do it if I am the star. So let's talk about Holiday, what actually happens in the film. So we meet Johnny Case, played by Cary Grant, and he is getting out of a cab, and he's going to see his friends, the Potters, Edward Everett Horton and Jean Dixon, who are a married couple. He's a college professor, and she's some sort of lecturer, probably a radical feminist of some kind, and that's not my interpretation. That's from the film and from what the Criterion Collection says about the origination of that character. In any case, Cary goes to see the Potters, and he says, hey, I've just met the girl of my dreams, and I'm going to go see her now, but I'm going to leave my bags here. And we get a little sense of the repartee between the Potters. I think Horton and Jean Dixon together are incredible. Horton by himself is always just really funny and really erudite and enjoyable to watch. But I really think those two have an incredible fun chemistry that you'll see throughout the movie.
Yeah, these are well-written parts, and they really do a great job of them. They've got they're great parts for people who character actors who can they can play it big, they can play it small. There's just a lot in there for them, little bits of business for them to do throughout the movie.
And it's pretty evenly balanced. It isn't lopsided where by this time Edward Everett Horton in 38 is Edward Everett Horton character actor brand, where you're used to the characterization that, you know, a lot of us probably know better from Fractured Fairy Tales in terms of our introduction to him before we were watching grown-up movies. We knew him from Jay Ward cartoons. That kind of persona, you go back to the 1930 version, and it's not there yet. And that's very much what you see him associated with. And he gets fun stuff to do. She gets fun stuff to do. And it's a refreshing difference to other movies that you see from the era, where it's outside of the lead female parts, things tend to be pretty lopsided and functional in terms of supporting roles given to women in a lot of cases.
Yeah, and she's not a young ingenue by any means. They're middle-aged people. And this was almost Jean Dixon's last movie. She's not somebody I know particularly well. She's a character actress, but she pretty much retired at this point in her career. I don't know why, but, a great way to go out, I guess is one way to look at it. Johnny Case, Cary Grant, is now going off to see his girl, and the cab lets him off at the address that he's been given. He's never been to this woman's house before, and he is flabbergasted because he's in front of a giant mansion on Fifth Avenue, and he says, well, maybe she works here. So he goes around to the kitchen entrance and asks for Julia, and the servants, who are somewhat flustered, the butler's putting on his coat, and he said, well, Julia's visitors usually come around the front of the house, and so they usher Cary Grant through the house and into the giant, enormous, mega Fifth Avenue mansion.
The size of a city block.
I mean, Judas!
It is so obscenely big.
Well, it looks like a public building when the cab pulls up.
Yeah,
right?
It looks like where you go to pay your utility bill and make sure they don't shut off your water. And I feel like casting this, being 9 years after the beginning of the Great Depression, with the stock market crash, it feels like the reframing of not just this, but various other elements of the movie are so beautifully, brilliantly done to reflect the era that they are in, to set the stage for, he thinks that, you know, this woman he fell in love with is just a regular old, you know, working class, working her way up, middle class kind of person. And oh no, she's with those, you know, stuffy upper crust ruling class plutocrats. You know, that's the kind of people that she comes from. And just the way that we're introduced to her family wealth is really nice, really, not as didactic as it could have been. But it is so over the top. They don't have to say much about it.
Well, you're with him because his reaction is amazement and he makes jokes about the size of the place, but he's just sort of stunned by what he's seeing. And then when Julia comes into the room, she's puzzled by what he's even talking about. She doesn't really understand why he would find this an unusual experience, which, again, I think that's great, because the alternative would be she's very high-handed and at some point she, you know, immediately realizes that there's a class separating them. That will come in time. But for now, she's just sort of puzzled and amused that he is as bothered or as unnerved by her wealth as he is.
I love that we didn't have to see them falling in love at the beginning of the movie. It's just him saying that to the Potters, and that's it. And apparently they shot it, and then they just threw out all the footage.
Right. Cukor said he didn't like it. They had shot a scene. They're supposed to have met at Lake Placid on a ski vacation, and George Cukor shot those scenes and basically said, I don't like it. And one of the reasons he did it was because this material was from a play. And there are a lot of movies, and this isn't one of them, but there are a lot of movies from the 30s that are evidently from plays. And I can see Cukor, who was a theater director before he directed films, and after as well, wanting to try and diminish the impression that it was a play. But yeah, I think it's right. I don't think we need that scene at Lake Placid.
Well, as in lots of romantic comedies, you don't understand why the two who are together at the beginning are together at the beginning anyway, because clearly Cary Grant doesn't belong with her. He belongs with Linda.
And we're about to meet her. And it makes it a lot easier later on, because Julia, the rich girl who is entirely comfortable in her surroundings, is neither warm nor cold to Cary Grant. She just sort of is. And I think that's going to make it a lot easier when Cary Grant meets Katharine Hepburn and eventually they figure out that they love each other.
Well, this is something that I also on the Incomparable Network, we recently launched a show called Agents of Smooch that I'm a part of that is all about the romance genre and not just romantic comedies, but just romance across various things. The thing that does to the formula is it prevents us getting invested in Julia and, you know, there really being much of a Team Julia, Team Linda thing. It just shortcuts to fixing the problem. And the problem is that they think that they fell in love with each other because that's what society expects of them and that's what they're supposed to do. And we don't have to waste time redoing the same chunk of this template story that has been, I mean, it's all over the screwball genre. Where, you know, this person and that person are destined for each other. And in cases of things like Gold Diggers of 1933, there are multiple threads of that happening simultaneously. And they're all, you know, this person's wrong for that person, that kind of thing.
So during this whole sequence, we're introduced to Julia and to Linda, played by Katharine Hepburn, and to Lou Ayers, who is the drunken brother. He basically has no memory of where he was last night, and the butler has kind of fixed him up. And he's all of the young ones, except Linda, interestingly enough, and it's never mentioned why, but Julia and Ned are on the way to church to meet their father. And the point of Julia going to church is so that she can tell her father about her engagement to Johnny Case, and Dad won't be able to make a scene because he's in church. But it's never addressed why Linda doesn't have to go to church. I think that's interesting. They do, in fact, move along to church, and Cary Grant is told to go away, and Julia mentions multiple times that he should change his tie. He's wearing a bow tie, and I don't know if it's that specifically or just that individual tie that's not liked, but sort of convoluted thing where he's supposed to go away and come back after they return from church, and it's supposed to be a surprise, and then the father will invite him in, but don't mention the engagement yet. We're just getting to know each other. So we meet the father in church, who is a very stern, taciturn, bankerly sort of individual, played by Henry Kolker, another character actor who just all the casting is so great. There's not a person in this movie who is miscast, in my opinion. We get a little ahead of ourselves in that Julia wants to have her father know what a comer, what a great guy Johnny Case is, and so the father is going to talk to Johnny's boss, because Johnny, even though he is an egalitarian, he works at a financial house, and one of the ways he's making a lot of money in order to do what he ultimately wants to do, which is quit work, which we'll get to shortly, is that he works in finance, and that means that in the small world of New York, the dad knows Johnny's boss, and so he's kind of going to get a reference from him at church. Then they all meet up back at home, and the father has very definite ideas about how the interview would go, and the kids are supposed to leave and excuse him and let Johnny and the father speak together as men, I suppose, and about financial things, but it doesn't quite go that way. We're very quickly learning that both Linda and Ned, in their own ways, are not exactly your typical rich offspring. Ned, of course, has a drinking problem, and he seems to be pretty unhappy about his lot in life. Linda is just a straight-up rebel is not really the right word. She's a poor little rich girl, I think, is used in one of the Criterion documentaries. But she seems to be completely at loose ends. She doesn't really like her life very much, but she doesn't really know what to do about it. She seems like a pretty strong personality, but yet she sort of stalks the house and lives in this upstairs playroom with all the musical instruments and all the trapezes and other things that we're going to come to be introduced to later in the movie, and seems unhappy, but seems unable to fix her own lot in life.
Ugh, what a millennial. All she wants to do is enjoy life and, you know, stay forever young in some respects and screw around and, you know, not entirely know precisely what she's going to do and not live out the kind of pre-prescribed life that her father once laid out and, you know, do things this way and that way. I don't know, maybe it's because it seems like the siblings were not given the opportunity to find a healthy way to grieve the loss of their mother, which is evidenced in the fact that their father wants them to do anything other than talk about feelings or what they want and focus only on things that they should do. It's an interesting dynamic in that you know what's going on politically and sociologically at the time that this was made and the way that that informed deviations from the source materials we've touched on a bit. But it's interesting that this almost, it reads differently than it would have maybe 20 years ago, where it would be a little sillier. And even though it's still silly, some of the silly parts have something that kind of relates to the place that a lot of people who are around the age of Hepburn and Grant in this movie find themselves kind of at loose ends of, well, you're supposed to do this, and if you do this, you can get this kind of a job. And it turns out that the formula doesn't actually work that way, functionally speaking. And there isn't just a single prescribed way that you're supposed to live your life and grow up and move on and so on. And so I feel like, particularly during the Reagan era, you know, yeah, she's lazy and she's, you know, doesn't want to do anything. And, you know, why wouldn't Cary Grant want to just, you know, keep plowing away to be the richest he can possibly be? You know, what is wrong with him? Doesn't he know that greed is good?
Well, I think the three kids are, you know, very different the way kids in movies are always very different. You know, you've got Julia, who is completely with the program of being a Seton. You have Linda, who is the oldest. That's a little bit outside, I think, the formula. Wouldn't Linda normally be the rambunctious one, usually be the younger one? But anyway, right. she's the older one, so she's breaking stereotype terribly here with her being the older one. But she's the rebel and is fighting. And Ned would be a rebel, but he's just broken. And that's why he drinks so much. And there are little bits here and there. I mean, first, he could be just a dissolute rich guy, which would be a normal stereotype. But you see that he's been beaten down by father a few times in the movie. You get to understand why he does, why he is a drunk, why he sort of does what father tells him to do ultimately after putting up a little bit of a protest. And of course, his drinking is entirely a protest. So you get those three. Father is a great part, and you know he's very stereotypical. I will say, in his what's his name Ed? I don't remember.
Edward is the father, and Ned. Oh, of course. Yeah, so I guess the son is named after his dad.
Yeah, Ned. He did leave the playroom intact, which is clearly mother's place, and it's kind of the place for rebellion in the family, and certainly he could have gotten rid of it, but he doesn't.
Well, my theory is he's not, he doesn't remember it's there.
Well, that could be true.
I think that's a piece of it, and it's also that he discourages them away from it, but he does have, in fact, a sentimental bone in his body, and he couldn't bear to completely get, I mean, it's not like he's lacking for rooms in this big gigantic house, and just knowing that it's there, even if it's frozen in amber, it's still a reminder of the wife that he lost.
Yeah, there's no indication that he didn't love his wife. He's just incapable of processing feelings for her or helping the kids process their feelings for her. He would just rather move on with his life and wishes that they would do the same. And he's not mean. He's not vindictive enough to say, we're going to destroy the playroom. Now, I suppose there's a situation in which if Linda decided to host the strikers from New Jersey that she helped long ago in the playroom, he might have, you know, had a different approach, but it doesn't affect him, is, I feel like, the main reason that it still exists. In this section of the movie, we get to hear both Cary Grant's philosophy, Johnny Case's, and sort of Linda's philosophy and history. And this is where we find out what Cary Grant's plan is. Johnny has been working since he was 10 in very hard physical labor, and then eventually he worked his way through Harvard and went into finance. And his idea is to make as much money as he needs to live for a time, it's an indeterminate time, then to quit business and to go on a holiday. So presumably this is months, years, some long period of time, not a few weeks. And then if he needs to go back to work at some point later on, he will. But as he says, he wants to quit business while he feels good all the time, so while he can enjoy it. He doesn't really say, I want to do this in the world, I want to see the Azores or the pyramids or anything. He's just saying, I want to enjoy my life, and I don't quite know what that is, but I want to enjoy it. And we learn that Linda is restless. She went through a phase where she wanted to be a nurse, and then she had a political phase where she helped some strikers in New Jersey, but it turns out that the strikers were working for a company her father owned, so I guess he put an end to that. And she seems completely at a loss. Also, the feelings among the siblings, I think, are fascinating. She worships her sister Julia. She just adores her and believes that they have an incredibly close relationship that is not borne out by evidence. And then Ned, I think, really cares for Linda. And one of the reasons that he cares for her so much is that he realizes the way in which Linda is misled by Julia, who pretty much is moving along with her life and doesn't feel Linda's pain in the way that Linda thinks she does. So all of the sibling relationships are, and Ned is very cynical, whereas regards Julia, not so much in this early part of the movie, but a little later on toward the end, Ned pretty much says to Linda, you know, Julia would run you over in a heartbeat. And Linda doesn't believe it because Linda is very immature. She's very emotional. I believe it's one of the documentaries on the Criterion disc says that the character is supposed to be 27. The character of Linda I'm talking about is supposed to be 27 and look 22. Hepburn was 31 when she made this, which doesn't really matter. But one of my favorite pastimes is looking up the ages of actors in IMDb when I'm watching movies. So I just thought,
yeah, all the 33-year-olds in high school over the ages.
Right. Oh, and another thing that was interesting about the Ned character, there are a lot of movies from the early 30s especially where there's the dissolute playboy who has been given no guidance by his parent, and so he goes out all night, he's getting girls pregnant, he's doing all the things you wouldn't want a young man to do. But very different than Ned. These are playboys. And in the 1930 version, I actually didn't watch it for this purpose, which I suppose I should have, but many of the characters that Robert Ames, who actually plays the Johnny Case character in the 1930 version, many of the characters he played were these dissolute playboys who are actually doing harm because their fathers are ignoring them, not paying attention to them. They have big trust funds. And even though it's the depths of the Depression, they're drinking and debauching their way through New York City. And Ned is just a complete misanthrope because, as you say, he's been broken by his father. And he's now just at the point of doing what his dad says, going to the office when his father tells him to. And even though there's a lot of, you know, native intelligence and desire to get out, you pretty much get the impression that he never will.
Yeah, Ned's an interesting character because he actually does, well, we grow maybe. We come to understand Ned. You know, we're introduced to him, as you said, Shelley, where he's, you know, with a hangover, getting dressed by the butler or getting his hat put on, his coat put on, and told, you know, essentially how he got the bump on his head. And, you know, being sent off to church. And we think that Ned is going to be one of these dissolute playboy types, but he's not. And we learn more about Ned as time goes on, including, you know, his insight, as you mentioned, into the family, where he's, you know, he tells Linda that if you were in her way, Julia would run you down like a rabbit, I believe was the quote. We learn a lot about Ned, which, you know, considering that he's pretty far down the totem pole in this movie, is a good thing. It's nice that they gave him stuff like that to do.
Ned, played by Lou Ayres, who was about to become Dr. Kildare.
He had been a
pretty big star in the early 30s with All Quiet on the Western Front, of which George Cukor was dialogue director. And then he had sort of a middling career in the 30s and was definitely a supporting role. He doesn't really have any impact on the movie or on what happens in the movie, but
he's a lot of fun to watch.
Yes,
though.
He's, I mean, in
another movie of the era of the type, he would be a distraction, or, you know, as you said, like this, the function of his character would be very different. And he's almost like the allegorical, you know, society insertion, almost, where it's like the forgotten man number in Goldfinger's in 1933, which I don't know why I'm talking about it so much, but I've seen it.
It's on my list of things to watch for this. I love that movie.
I've seen it so many times, going back to my dance in the movies class in college. But that my forgotten man number in the movie, these various post-depression and during the depression movies, it's something that it's not exclusive to a particular director or writer, but there are these things that just get slipped in there. In the most notable of these, that I think is part of the reason that they've ended up hanging on in terms of lasting value, is that there's something being said about where the world was, where the United States was sociologically at a point. And there's a thing a little bit later on that I'd forgotten was in the movie because it'd been a while since I'd seen it, that's along these lines. But yeah, his plot wise, he doesn't move the quest along. He doesn't discover the MacGuffin. He doesn't, you know, tell somebody a secret they shouldn't hear. He's just around and hanging out.
I think one of the reasons he exists is to provide that sort of connective tissue among the siblings, because I think it would be very, the things he says about Julia writing Linda down like a rabbit, I think would be pretty obvious to us. We don't need him to tell us that, but I believe his being there provides a really interesting set of connective tissue for the siblings, especially as they are apart from their father, and each of them relates to the other in a really different way. The only relationship that isn't really fleshed out at all is Julia and Ned. I think you can probably guess that Julia doesn't have much use for Ned because Ned drinks and so on.
Right.
And we know what Ned thinks of Julia. But as three siblings rather than just two sisters trying to fight it out, it just makes it really interesting dramatically to watch.
Yeah, we don't need Ned to tell us about Linda and Julia, but Linda does. And that's especially near the end of the movie. That's his purpose.
Pretty soon, we get everybody downstairs, and even though the intention wasn't to bring up the engagement, it happens very quickly, and Julia says to her father, I want a short engagement, because Julia wants what Julia wants when she wants it, and she has her dad wrapped around her little finger, probably because she is exactly what he expects and wishes her to be. And Linda is just really very engaged and involved. She wants this to happen, too. And she says it's because she wants Julia to have what she wants. And not typical of romantic comedies, it's not directly clear that she's doing this because she's in love with Johnny. She's totally falling in love with him. But she's in love with the idea of him. She's in love with how different he is than the other people in her life. And I think she already sees him as a lifeline, but she doesn't even realize that that's the case. And that's why she's lobbying her father so hard on Julia's behalf, which is probably hurting Julia's case, actually.
Yeah, and he's not so samey and boring. It's not that she finds him particularly interesting. It's that he just is different. And that's enough for her because of how incredibly... almost assembly line manufactured all of her other options have been. She doesn't even appreciate all of the things that she could appreciate about him, which are the reasons that Linda falls completely head over heels for him. But Linda has so much devotion to her sister that she would never presume to think of herself in the face of, well, if this will actually make her sister happy. And It's one of the things that I love that they just made the subtext text at one point and just went, oh, no. And it's, you know, she's not really in love with him. It's that, you know, he's right for her and that makes her happy. When she finally gives up caring or trying, I appreciated that it was just said that plainly, that there wasn't a kind of her convincing herself that she was absolutely madly crazy for these parts of him that she might as well have not even noticed, but, you know, frankly, become more and more bits of annoyance to her over time. You know, why don't you just, you know, bend and heal and, you know, be tamed the way that effectively all the other guys that she found too boring ended up, you know, that's what all of them did. And that's what isn't going to be the case with Johnny Case.
Johnny Case never tells Julia his plan for the holiday. He tells Linda, but it's clear that Julia wouldn't be for it. And there's a point at which later on, when Johnny is overwhelmed by all the plans and all the money and all the things that the Setons want to heap on him, he fights back. But he never sits down and says, and you don't get the impression he did when they were at Lake Placid together. He never says, look, Linda, or look, Julia, this is my idea. And that's dumb on his part, because once he figures out who Julia is, even if he doesn't understand the depths of her personality, the background that she has, the father that she has, it's pretty dumb of him and clueless of him to never even have that conversation with her.
Well, you know, to be fair to Johnny, he doesn't know that she is who she is until he's come to the house. And it is that very day that he brings up once he's, you know, there. That is the day that he brings up the holiday. Yes, he does tell Linda first, which is a little weird, but... You know, he breaks it to Julia and the father that same day, doesn't he? Have I forgotten that?
I think it's a little later. He's not.
Is it at the party?
It's at the party or thereafter. It's not right here because they're consumed in the day when they meet. They're consumed with, can we get engaged? Can we have a short engagement? And then the party comes up, the idea that there will be a party. And Linda's like, hey, this guy is great. And Julia's like, hey, let's have a short engagement. I don't think they get around to, and then the subject of where Johnny works, the fact that he works at Sloan Hobson and may have this deal cooking, that's discussed. But Johnny doesn't ever get around to saying, hey, well, you know, if it goes through, Dad,
once it goes through,
I'm out
I'll be
here.
Done. Yeah.
So earlier, before Dad met Johnny, Linda and Julia had a chance to talk, and Linda says this thing. She says, I really want to throw a party for you guys. Just us up here in the playroom, just our friends. Can we do it? And Julia's like, yeah, sure. Yeah, totally. I'll let you do that. And of course, pretty soon, the next thing we see is that there is this enormous ball going on down in, and everybody is in formal dress. It's a New Year's Eve ball. And the plan is that that is when the father will announce the engagement of Johnny and Julia. And of course, Linda is nowhere to be found because she's pouting up in the playroom. And everybody wants to know where Linda is. Linda has a sick headache is the basic response. There's a lot of funny business. The Potters make their reappearance at this point. Edward Horton and Gene Dixon. Hilarious.
What a wonderful entrance they get.
So great.
You know, the servants thinking that, you know, that that they've taken his hat and they've taken his shoe, and it just, you know, the little bits of dumb show are almost a precursor to what we get later in the playroom with the Punch and Judy dolls. But the two of them, Mr. Potter in particular, feeling like maybe we should just go. this seems like a bad idea. yeah, just from the moment they reappear, it was a point in the movie where I needed that little pick me up. And they were just the perfect little mid-course break in this feast of a screwball comedy.
Yeah, because whatever you want to say about Linda being immature and not really knowing what she wants, you obviously are in sympathy with her. You feel for her. And I found myself, if I thought about it, what was actually happening, I wanted to say, well, you know, you can kind of take your destiny into your own hands. You don't have to live this life. You have all the resources. Your father is not keeping you a prisoner. But emotionally, I was just like, oh, this is so sad. And you're right, that the comedy comes just at the point when you need it, because it's so unbearable that Linda has been so completely separated from her sister that she can't even bear to come down to the party, and that there's nobody who's in sympathy with her. And so we need the comic relief. We also meet the villains, Seton Cram and his wife.
The best name for anyone in a movie.
I don't remember that actor's name, but he went on to play Nazis in the World War II era.
He played so many Nazis.
So we have, and they're just, and the wife has just got this.
They're just the worst. They're just so
terrible, terrible
awful.
But they're the Crams.
There are a lot of jokes at their expense. Just the, what is Linda, when they come to the playroom, oh, it's the witch and Dopey. It's so good.
And yeah, and they get the Sieg Heil in this movie,
yes,
from 1938, where we were seeing it was not as easy and popular in quote unquote liberal Hollywood to speak out against fascism or put it in your movies. At this time, a whole lot of people were not, they weren't sounding the alarm bells about Hitler. And the fact that this is in a movie that was made in 1937 for debut in 1938, not many studios were letting that kind of stuff, even in the sly way that it kind of got slipped in sideways here. They weren't really letting that in there, and it's fascinating to see, especially seeing as the I don't know, the context of Mr. Cram saying, if we had the right kind of government, it had been a while since I'd seen this movie. I'll put it this way, it'd been since before 2016 that I last saw this movie.
Yeah.
And it just...
I had forgotten about that line.
Yeah, I had forgotten about that line, and it fits really nicely.
Yes.
About plutocrats going, well, who needs rules, really? Let's just not have any rules. It'll be fine.
So then we go up to the playroom. We have a nice long interlude where characters are arriving and being entertaining. There are backflips. The Punch and Judy show occurs, which I think is just brilliantly done. Even the Witch and Dopey come up, and that's where he says the thing about the government is actually uttered up in the playroom, I believe. And we find out that Johnny has indeed made the business success that somehow will enable him to quit business. And he tells Linda his exciting news. And again, Julia's downstairs, so he doesn't get to tell her his exciting news about quitting business. That's not something that's been mentioned before.
And she won't be particularly excited about this whole notion of quitting business.
No, No, I don't think so. The playroom scenes are great. The dialogue is snappy. The use of props and physical comedy, the giraffe, the backflip, the whole, you know, even the bit where Katharine Hepburn gets on Cary Grant's shoulders and her long dress obscures his face so she can't do the flip over. It's just like, it's such, so good. So good.
A friend asked me at some point if I had seen this movie, and I was like, oh yeah, it's a movie with Cary Grant putting his head up Katharine Hepburn's dress. And they reacted with some alarm, and I was like, it'll make sense when you see it. So just watch the movie. It'll be fine.
Which is different than the movie where Cary Grant puts his hand on Katharine Hepburn's butt through his hat. But that's a different movie.
Yep.
The playroom is fun, but all too soon the interlude is interrupted because we've sort of dealt with the evil villains, but Julia comes up and Cary Grant is dispatched to go downstairs to the party. And ultimately he is kind of realizing that he's kind of in a spot. He can't take Linda's side at his own engagement party, and he's trying to get Linda to come down and be a part of it, and he's really stuck in the middle. And had this marriage actually occurred, I think that's how Cary Grant would have spent his entire life.
Yeah, the line here that I wrote down is Julia saying to Cary Grant, you haven't any idea yet how exciting business can be. yeah.
Why, all of the spreadsheets, darling. Think of the pivot tables, my dear.
Dad offers Cary Grant a desk at the bank. The marriage is going to happen. Of course, the engagement announcement is done from a floor above all of the dancing people as the beautiful people in the tuxedos are making the announcement. And I wonder, because Seton's business is as a banker, I sort of wonder how many people down below are there because it's good to be in the good graces of your banker. Sure, some of them are as wealthy as he is, but I kind of wondered as I saw that scene where he's making the announcement from above, how many people felt like they had to be at that party?
I would gather most of them.
All of them, yeah.
That's the way that I, you know, from watching movies and never having been part of that class of society, I gather that it's just part of being in the upper class that it is a life of obligation. It is a life of nothing but obligations. Regardless of the fact that they are obligations that are foisted on you, you're still the one making the choice to keep fulfilling them. And that's why I like Johnny Case, because he makes the choice to say, F that.
Yep. So we get a nice little interlude with Lou Ayres and Katharine Hepburn up in the playroom. He's trying to explain to her what being drunk is like, and both of them are very sad. And I guess just as we needed the comic interlude before, I felt like this interlude is well placed too, because you have this sort of situation that cannot stand where Cary Grant is going to be absorbed into this family, Borg-like, but you know that's never going to work. And so we go upstairs and we're reminded that not only are these people full of witty repartee, but they have both of them are just deeply sad. And he especially, Lou Ayres has got depression in this movie. It's clear. He's also completely incapable of changing his lot. And I think you can probably figure out at that point in the movie that he is not going to escape.
Right. And before that, I think it was just before that, because it's before Johnny escapes. Johnny and Linda dance up in the playroom, right, to the Blue Danube. They have a waltz, which tells us all, if we didn't already know, that they are made for each other and that something has to happen to get them together.
Yes. And there's a moment where I think they're both realizing it, which is the point. And they're, you know, she's fighting it every time it comes up. It's clear that she's fighting it. In that moment is probably when she is realizing what she's fighting. And then subsequently she's like, oh, no, she always fights it in terms of, no, I wouldn't do that to my sister, who, of course, would run her down like a rabbit.
Exactly. Yeah. Johnny would go for it. Johnny is ready to switch horses midstream here. But she sends him off because she can't betray her sister at this point. Well, actually, at any point.
Right. She only takes action when Julia essentially gives her permission and tells her she doesn't care at the end of the movie.
Because a Hollywood movie in the 30s, nobody would ever, no heroine would get away with being unvirtuous and, untrue knowingly, or you know, deceiving people, because such roles, women simply cannot be good if they do such things. If they act in self-interest, they must always be entirely paragons of virtue. Though men can make a few mistakes. That's fine.
Right. So those wild oats. So Johnny ultimately takes off because he can't figure out how to resolve the situation. He's feeling pressured. He disappears for some days. The next thing we see is Linda going to the Potter's residence to see if she can find out where Johnny is. As it happens, it's on the day that the Potters and Johnny are going to sail away. And Linda's still in there pitching for Johnny and Julia, although you get the impression that she has neither talked to Julia nor has Julia expressed any particular desire for Johnny to come back, because nobody's heard from him in several days. But Linda is still very passionately making that case, and the Potters are like, hey, you're in love with him. You realize that, right? And she actually admits it, but I think it's saying it out loud and talking to them that lets her admit that to herself explicitly.
Yeah, and at this point, I believe it's the Potters, right, that are Johnny's making one last pitch to Julia to go on the boat with him, and the Potters get a telegram. Oh, the Porters, right? Because everybody gets
their name.
Yes,
the Porters.
they get a telegram from Johnny, who is apparently, maybe they don't have a phone, but they get a telegram. You know, Julia has turned Johnny down. So Linda is then going to run off to go convince Julia that Johnny is the best thing that could ever happen to her.
And so briefly, Johnny and Julia and the father, everybody gets all in the same room again. And Johnny's like, all right, I'll give in. I'll do this for a couple of years. But then if I don't like it, I'm going to leave. And basically Julia and the father are like, yeah, sure, whatever. And they immediately begin planning their honeymoon trip, which involves visiting relatives and important people in London and Paris. And then Julia says, when can the house be ready, Dad? And he's like, oh, March 1st. And will you arrange for the servants? And Johnny is like, oh, yeah, this is why I left. And so he takes off. And then Johnny and Linda and Ned and Julia and the father all have words, at which point Linda basically says, come on, Ned, let's go. And because Julia has said in no uncertain terms, I don't want him. I'm really happy. I feel really good about this. At which point Linda gives herself permission to go and be with Johnny. And she tries to get Ned to go with her. And Ned cannot go. He will not go. Linda leaves. She goes to the boat where the Porters and Johnny are sailing. Those are some large staterooms and wide hallways. Let me just say that because it's the 30s. And she meets up with Johnny. They do a last clinch. He's done his backflip. He's on the floor, and she bends down to face him. And that's how we end the movie.
Oh, poor Ned. He would not go with the rest of the elves west of Lothlorien.
Ned is stuck, being an unhappy banker with a quart of scotch in his boot.
This is a troublesome movie for me, for a few reasons. First is I cannot help but compare it to Bringing Up Baby and The Philadelphia Story, both of which I rank much, much higher than this movie. And I think they have a brightness to them. Now, Philadelphia Story has some dark parts too, but they're just, to me, they're just better movies than this. And so as I'm watching this movie, I cannot help but think, oh, I wish this was more like Bringing Up Baby instead of this. I think there's not, it doesn't have the screwball aspects to it, which of course I like.
Have any leopards. I mean,
no leopards.
Big cats always make it better.
No giant skeletons. None of that stuff. I don't. What the hell?
No Charlie Ruggles.
No. Well, yes. No James Stewart.
Right.
There are these couple of places. So Katharine Hepburn does some remarkable silent acting in this movie. There are a couple of places that I just adore what she's doing. There's the part where Julia when Johnny is in the house for the first time, and Julia is not happy with the way he's dressed and the way his hair is, and she wants the different tie and all of that. And while she's sort of talking to Johnny and Johnny is kind of protesting, Linda, Katharine Hepburn, is sort of straightening out Cary Grant's suit and straightening out his tie and flicking little things away from him and stuff like that. And it's a wonderful bit of business that she's doing that defines her character really well and makes her lovable. A lot of other things that don't make her lovable. There's some depth to her character, like the whole section where she is pouting up in the room during the party does not make you like Linda. You might be sympathetic to her for having her plans taken away from her, but you know, it is her sister's engagement party. It's not really her thing.
Yeah. She's Grey Gardensing herself, and you want that free spirit to roam free, and she's refusing it of herself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's another part, I don't remember exactly where it is in the movie, where she gives to her father the most sarcastic smile I think I've ever seen. And again, not talking, she just does something physically that defines her character very well, better than any of the speeches that she gives. And that brings me to the speeches. There are a couple of them where it goes on too long. And this is not her fault. These speeches were given to her. But when she's just about to go off, I think Ned has already said, no, I can't go. And she turns to tell everyone off and, you know, whatever he does is all right with me. If he wants to dream for a while, he can dream for a while. If he wants to do peanuts, oh, I will love those peanuts.
That reminds me of Philadelphia Story. There are speeches in that hit me the same way.
There are. And it's a thing that people, it's the same writer, right?
Yeah, it's Phil Berry.
Yeah, well, and also the same screenwriter.
Yes, Donald Logren. I didn't talk about him, but yeah, the same screenwriter, Donald Logren Stewart, who also wrote Woman of the Year. He wrote several Cukor Hepburn collaborations.
Yeah, so it's a tough thing for her to sell, because the speech goes on a ways, and you know but she doesn't sell it, I don't think. There are a lot of things in this movie where I'm thinking too much about the movie and the mechanics of the movie instead of just going along for the ride, which is really what I should be doing.
I get where you're coming from, and I see this.
You don't have to be nice. You can lay into
No,
me.
No,
no,
it's not that. For me, my paradigm for it is that I like them different. I like Holiday different than I like Bringing Up Baby, than I like Philadelphia Story, because I get slightly different. I get different variations of flavors that I like. If you look at Grant and Hepburn in this versus Bringing Up Baby, in Bringing Up Baby, they are radically more slapstick, and you just get a little breath of that in a couple of places in Holiday. And there's a bit, it's a little bit more buttoned down. It's a little bit, I don't know. I have trouble comparing them in a way other than I think of them all. Bringing Up Baby is my favorite, but it's difficult for me to feel like I don't know. I've gotten really against this whole ranked list thing with films. It just started to bug me because everything has to be a list of, you know, top five this, top 17 this, that kind of thing, and it's filtered around to, you know, I like or I don't like something, and I like all of these movies. Do I rewatch Holiday as much as I do Bringing Up Baby, which I threw on just for fun a couple weeks ago, literally a couple weeks ago? No. But sometimes this, you know, this is what I want to watch instead of Bringing Up Baby. It's actually one that I kind of consider a Christmas/New Year's movie, because it's a Christmas/New Year's movie.
Well, it is. Yeah. The Holiday is a double meaning.
Just plain is. People go, oh, it's not a Christmas movie because it's not about Christmas. And I'm like, all right, well then here's the Santa Claus. Go have fun, kids. you know, it's something that I get a different craving for this one than I do the others, where to an extent, I could watch Bringing Up Baby or Philadelphia Story pretty much any time. But this one, I want to watch this one at a time that I'm fine leaving the other two on the shelf. You know, carefully organized by spine number with the rest of my ridiculous Criterion collection.
See, I'm kind of a Hepburn completist, and I feel like I enjoy watching her in Holiday because I feel like it's one of the few performances where she really has some vulnerability and in an interesting and intentional way. And I'm not saying that vulnerability is the mark of a good actress, especially Hepburn by any means. But Philadelphia Story, which is sort of the archetypal Hepburn performance, and it did, you know.
Hello, I'm Catherine Hepburn, and I'm made of steel, darling.
Exactly. And yes. I find of those three movies, Philadelphia Story is the one I like the least. I've seen it many times. I like to go see it in, you know, summer classic theater presentations when it happens. It's fun, but Holiday brings me joy. Bringing Up Baby brings me joy. Bringing Up Baby is sort of a special movie for my husband and I. We watch it on my birthday sometimes, and I try not to watch it because it's so slapstick. If I watch it too much, I'm going to see all the jokes coming and it won't be so funny. But I really enjoy this one, and I found watching Holiday recently for this purpose, I saw it differently. I think when I first watched it in college, I was in complete sympathy with Linda. It didn't occur to me that she was immature. The idea that she would stay in the playroom during her sister's party seemed perfectly sensible to 21-year-old me. And I'm supposed, that's the way you're supposed to feel. And I think now I can see both the flaws in the character of her own making and also what the actor is doing. And because there are fewer of those sort of ponderous speeches than there are in Philadelphia Story. And some of the ideas in the Philadelphia Story are just irritating. Like, you know, you should be nicer to your dad. I know he was cheating on your mom, but he's trying. And various other things. I like Cary Grant a lot in the Philadelphia Story because his character is very, very different than he is here or in Bringing Up Baby. And I find that interesting because it's actually a part that shows a wider kind of range of Cary Grant, because Cary Grant is somebody who's prone to sort of imitation and stereotype.
He got like stamped out into this, you know, the Cary Grant slapstick mold of this is what he does for a bunch of movies running, where he was pretty much doing the same thing and being hired to do the same thing.
Holiday is interesting. The ideas in it are interesting not that they're great, big, earth-shattering ideas. But you think about, well, you may not want to be on the side of the bankers who believe that money should be your god. How should I feel about what Cary Grant wants to do? Or should I have an opinion? I think that's something worth thinking about. He's taking a holiday. He's worked himself into a position of sufficient privilege that he can go do that. So good for him, or not.
something you hit on that I think is probably also part of what maybe boost the average for me on Holiday as compared to the way that most people rank it, is the progression of Hepburn's career and her screen persona. In that essay I mentioned that's in the booklet, that you can read the essays for all Criterion stuff on their website, even if you don't buy the bazillion Blu-rays that they've got. But Dana Stevens from Slate, she wrote this essay that does a beautiful job of contextualizing the phase of Hepburn's career that she was in, going back to Hope Williams, the woman who she understudied on Broadway in this play and who she idolized and patterned herself after, to the point of the reason that they were compared to each other apparently was that she was kind of doing her version of Hope Williams. And this is around the point where she found that divergence and developed the Katharine Hepburn screen persona that became what people know her for, from The African Queen, from her pictures of Spencer Tracy and so on. And in Bringing Up Baby, we've got more apparently of her trying to do her best version of Hope Williams. And this is her at that inflection point where she's kind of bridging the version of herself she thinks she has to be and the version of herself that she can just choose to be going forward.
I feel like bringing a baby is also transitional for her because she actually went through with Howard Hawks and with other people, not him so much because Hawks was not the kind of guy to give this sort of direction, but she actually talked to and worked with comedians who basically showed her how to be funny because she had never done, not to mention slapstick or screwball, she'd never really done comedy before, and she felt intimidated by it, and her performance in Bring Up Baby is very different than anything else she's ever done. I can't speak to whether
it's
how
completely
Hope Williams did
it's completely unlike Little Women, unlike Alice Adams, like all which
Stage
which
Door, any of those things,
Stage Door, all this stuff,
right? And so it feels like that's kind of the end of her RKO contract. Then she comes and does this. Then she spends 2 years making a huge, enormous hit in Philadelphia Story. And then she comes back. She's worked at RKO, which is not quite a bottom-of-the-barrel studio, but it's not MGM. And then she comes and waltzes into Louis B. Mayer's office, and she says, you want the Philadelphia Story? You have to take me, and these are the people I want to star in it. So let's see. Just for folks who might want to watch Holiday, it is streaming at many places, and I will post links in the show notes. Also, there is a brand-new Criterion edition, as Moises mentioned. There's also a version of Holiday on DVD if you happen to have the Cary Grant collection, which is some years old. And I mention it just because there's a little documentary that tells that story about them having shot some scenes in Lake Placid. I originally thought there was a commentary on it, and I was excited about that. And I went back and found that box set, which I have, and there is not such a commentary. But the Cary Grant collection is a good set of Grant movies that actually show his range pretty well, if you're interested in that.
Yeah, this is one that, you know, people who have a Blu-ray player but rarely use it and very selectively choose what they buy physical media copies of, it's one that if you're a big Katharine Hepburn or Cary Grant or Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant fan, such that you would buy and own, for example, the Criterion Collection versions of Philadelphia Story or Bringing Up Baby. You know, I feel like this is one that when Barnes & Noble does their 50% off sale and they're $20 instead of $40, maybe worth the $20 just to have it because it looks gorgeous.
It really does.
And the extras are nice. And like we said, it's got the 1930 version on there so that you can either watch the whole thing or watch about a half hour and fall asleep with the cat on your lap. Like I did.
I think I may try the 1930 version sometime. Yeah, I watched the
it's
first scene, and what I remembered about it, because I think I'd seen it a long time. What I remembered
I'd forgotten
about
Mary Astor was in it.
Oh yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah. I love me some Mary Astor.
Yeah,
but the dialogue, a lot of it, at least in the scenes that they took that go forward to the 1938, a lot of the dialogue is directly from the play. I mean, they made various changes in the film, but you will, especially if you watch the first little bit. You will not feel as if you're watching a different film at all. It's not as good by any means, and it's 1930, which is an interesting period. If you've never watched a film from 1930, it's kind of different.
how is the sound?
It's because okay. It's
fair.
I mean, it's
yeah.
It's been restored, but it sounds like 1930s recorded
yeah.
sound. They didn't go overboard trying to clean it up and take the hiss all the way out of it. That would otherwise, you know, affect it and make it seem weird. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it looks and feels like a movie from 1930, but with the Criterion polish on it, such that you're
nice.
Not watching something that looks like it was lifted off of a Laserdisc.
And I think that's the only way you can watch that movie on disc. I doubt it's streaming, but I'm not certain about that. Don't quote me on that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's not streaming anywhere.
Yes.
I noticed. And I watch this streaming.
Sony Columbia is not as good as Warner Brothers is with Warner Archive in terms of making the stuff available. They made a sort of feudal gesture at launching their own thing using some of the same manufacturer on demand facilities, but not having the kind of infrastructure built the way that Warner Archive was. That's another thing I'll say to folks listening to this who are into them old movies is if you are not already into Warner Archive and what they've been doing for 10-something years, give them a check because there's some really great stuff that they found a way to sustainably make a thing that isn't Criterion work in terms of restoring and re-releasing movies in HD that have been out of print on DVD for 15 years.
Well, gentlemen, thanks so much for joining me for this little conversation about Holiday. Before I let you go, tell me where people can find you on the web and what you do. Let's start with you, Moises.
On Twitter, Instagram, at Moiseschiu, M-O-I-S-E-S-C-H-I-U. I do a bunch of episodes of The Incomparable. I do Agents of Smooch, new to The Incomparable, all about romance. My podcast of my own that has been on hiatus for a long time is coming back with an interview I did with Dick Cavett and the director of the, Cavett Ali, documentary that just recently hit HBO. And Nicholas Meyer and some Doctor Who people and a bunch of other stuff, that has been, I've been banking for literal years now. Electricshadow.net is where I ostensibly write about stuff. But that ostensibly is about to become, a great deal more, prolific, I should say. So, take a look.
Good stuff.
Moises, do you do a Dick Cavett impersonation? I imagine you have to. I imagine your finger is to your lips right now.
My Dick Cavett it's never been as good as my Johnny Carson was, and I haven't done my Johnny Carson in long enough that I'd slip into it, but I'm worried I'd trip and fall.
Dr. Drang, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, I am taking a bit of a break from Twitter right now. So I don't, although I'm Dr. Drang there, there's nothing there for a while. And maybe we'll
follow
not
Dr. Drang
there.
Nowhere on Twitter.
Yeah, that's right. My stuff is at leancrew.com, LEANCREW. And that's where I do blogging like I've been doing for a lot of years. I am one of the last amateur bloggers around.
Well, you are one of the people who I think I came to later than others, but who has been a model for me in owning a place where all of your stuff that you own, that you make of your own, lives. And I'm firing my engines back up, and now I'm on a podcast with you. So now I'm putting my feet to the literal fire, and thanking you for teaching us these lessons, Doctor.
Well, it's not, you know, Brent Simmons is probably the biggest avatar of that.
Oh, who cares about a Brent Simmons? What's he ever done?
Well, yes,
exactly. They've been wonderful.
I have a confession that I have a site that has my name on it, but I keep forgetting to put the things I make on it, which seems like a bad practice. But
yeah, my blog site, I mean, it's frozen in amber from when I last tried to revive it, but it goes back to in 2004. But I think a bunch of those entries got garbled, and I still need to fix them because of multiple shifts from one place to another. The guy who I now completely disassociate myself with, who writes a site called Hollywood Elsewhere, Jeffrey Wells, who wrote for Mr. Showbiz and Movie Poop Shoot when that was a thing under Kevin Smith. He put out the call for sub columnists who he gave complete editorial freedom to, and he opened up his Rolodex and whatever, and just kind of left me alone. But it goes back to my college film blogging days, when I would do bonkers things like try to do a chronological retrospective of the career of Yasujito Ozu. As one does, and then collapse under the weight of the ridiculous task I had given myself.
Well, I don't have yet a social media presence for this show, but if you're listening, you found it on The Incomparable. You can find me on Twitter at Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-Y. And that's enough to be going on with. I do some other things, but if you care enough, you can find them. They're out there. Next time on Lions, Towers, and Shields, we will be talking about the wonderful pre-code movie Babyface from 1933, starring the incredible Miss Barbara Stanwyck. That will be arriving in 2 weeks, so get your copies now. It is streaming out there. It is also available for purchase if you wish. This one is going to be fun. And until then, goodbye for now.